Welcome to the Going to Seed podcast. I'm your host, Shane Simonson, and today we are talking to Richard Paul Watson, who is coordinating a local seed saving and crop breeding group in far-flung New Zealand. So, Richard.
Yes, hello. How are you doing?
Hello. So, tell me about your background to get us started.
My background? I suppose my love of growing really goes back to my childhood. I used to have a wee section of my father's garden that I used to grow all sorts of stuff in. And my mother used to say that I had the most untidiest of gardens, but always grew the most. So I sort of had a break from my gardening when I sort of got to that 17-year-old sort of age where cars and booze sort of came along, and I was distracted for a few years till I got married and rediscovered the joys of gardening again. It was that period then that I came across the work of Kay Baxter in the North Island, New Zealand, where she was on a mission to try and track down the remaining heirloom cultivars that were still in existence in New Zealand. And the idea of that sort of quite appealed to me. So I joined up with her, along with two or three other people who also got involved in learning how to grow seed. In those days, I really had no idea what I was doing, and there wasn't a lot of information in those days, really, because we're talking sort of the mid-90s to the late 90s. But we learned as we went along, and I slowly got better and better at it. Still working with Kay and growing a lot of the seed lines that she had built up. When I was first married, there was a neighbour, an elderly neighbour, who had an old carrot that he had been growing and saving seed from for virtually most of his life. It had no name. He'd had it for so long. And that became the basis of my very first seed or seed line. And that seed line evolved into what is known as Ben Horn today. In those first earlier years, I never really produced good quality seed because I was only using a very small number of plants, only four or five plants. I didn't know that you had to use a lot more in those days. Mm-hmm. So it was very heavily inbred in those days. But eventually I did actually cross that with a number of other carrots in the early 2012. I did my first cross of different types of carrots. I don't remember which ones they were. They were just a few that I'd bought out of a garden centre. This was about the time that I was starting to sort of read about Joseph Lofthouse's work, and that was through the Home Grown Goodness Forum, which there was a few other people who were doing likewise as well. In those days, the early ones that I started to work on was leeks, carrots, and beetroot were my very first ones I started to play with. The leeks, I gathered up all the cultivars that I could find in New Zealand and swapped them with a lady and Jennifer in Canada. And she had done likewise with all the Canadian varieties. And she crossed all them, and we ended up swapping seed and crossing the two together. It was quite interesting that I remember her saying that some of the New Zealand cultivars were actually doing better in Canada than the Canadian ones were. But I actually found the opposite here. The Canadian ones did not really sort of do that well here.
Interesting.
They were slightly darker in the leaf pattern compared to the New Zealand ones. Mm. I see you have a photograph of a leek there that I had emailed to you.
I'll put that up. So, I love the look of that. This might be putting you on the spot a little bit, but can you tell, because we've got listeners from all around the world, do you know much about the agricultural history of New Zealand? Like how, because it's a relatively young nation on many levels. So do you have a sense about how its agricultural heritage came together? I'm not asking for like a PhD thesis on this, but just some broad brush ideas for people around the world. Because it's probably quite an obscure topic.
Yeah, academically, academia tends to regard this as a young country, but there is actually proven science that human occupation of these lands go back far, far further than what we are being led to believe. Mm. So I can only sort of go back to really to the early Maori and what they what they brought out here. There was the ancient or the older strains of Coomera or sweet potato. But those original strains actually were not very productive, and they're very hard to find nowadays. All the strains that we have in the supermarkets actually come from the Philippines and are a lot more productive.
Is if I recall, that's because the Maori came from a more tropical location, so the crops they brought with them could only grow in the very northern tip of New Zealand, and even then not very well.
They were still able to grow them in the South Island, but they had various tricks that they used to use. They used to use a lot of rocks, and of course the rocks would absorb the heat in the daytime and were able to keep the plants growing through through the cooler parts of the year. They certainly embraced the potato when the potato arrived with the Europeans, and they certainly grew a lot of those after those. But they kept those older strains going in the North Island up till fairly recently, and you can still get those older strains. But as I said, they're not very productive. They used to use a lot of a number of the native plants as well.
Yeah,
Peko
they were
Peko was another.
starting to domesticate some of those species, I believe.
And some of them were carcinogenic, and they never actually would understood why, or what was the cause of their short lifespan. And a lot of it was the eating bracken roots, or the foon roots, as being carcinogenic. They were, of course, they were big hunters of birds, and of course, kaimoana of the seafood as well. So that's really the basis of the horticulture. It was quite limited, really. They didn't really have a lot of. They still didn't have the variety we have today. And of course, the Europeans brought a lot of different cultivars over once they settled here as well.
And then in more recent generations, there's been migrants from a much wider diversity of places, I believe.
Yes, that's right. And I think back to my childhood, and you think just the number of cultivars that we had to choose from was so limited. We just have never have heard of a Yarcon or Skerrett or all these other obscure vegetables. Never even heard of them. And so we're quite lucky that we have so much choice today. We can certainly dabble in a lot more cultivars than what my father could have ever achieved.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but New Zealand seems to have a very innovative and experimental agricultural culture. But the perfect example of that is breeding and developing the kiwi fruit from semi-domesticated ancestors in like central China. Like that's quite visionary for the time that it happened.
That's right. And of course, the green kiwi fruit was the first that they improved, and then came along the golden fruit, and more recently they've come out with a red. I've tasted the red, and I don't think the red's anything really to write home about. It's okay. It's not. I prefer the golden kiwi fruit myself. The climate that I live in, I'm just not quite. It's just not quite ideal for doing the likes of kiwi fruit. You can grow them under trees and grow them in amongst trees, and that's one way to protect them. My climate, where I am in the South Island, is it's a challenging climate. We
Yeah,
get a lot
tell
of
us more about your local growing conditions. What are you up against?
winds, lots of winds. We're on the eastern side of the Southern Alps, so the downward side of the Roaring Forties, like any wind, speeds up as it goes downhill. So we get a lot of winds during the spring, and sometimes you can go into summertime as well. The autumns are our best time of year. They're generally the most settled, and in winters we can get snow. It's not a common thing. Frosts we can expect to get. Most winters you'll get down to -7, sometimes -8 Celsius. Sorry, I can't convert that to Fahrenheit. I don't know. I think it's around about 18, I think it is in Fahrenheit, is our minimum. We can get an occasional severe frost once every 15, 20 years. We can get down to -12 Celsius. And that really challenges a lot of the plants that are sort of on the borderline between being able to handle this climate. For example, feijoas. I don't know what feijoas are called overseas. Are they called feijoas
Oh, they are
elsewhere
in
in the world? I don't.
Australia.
Yeah. What are they called? The guava of I'm sure they're called Fujiwaras overseas, aren't they?
I'm pretty sure they are. And they're quite distinct from
Yeah.
guavas. You couldn't confuse them.
Yeah. For example, Fujiwaras is, I had a, in my orchard, I had about 15 nursery bought cutting grown on rootstock Fujiwaras, and I had dabbled around it with seedlings from a coastal orchard, and this particular orchard had quite a number of different cultivars that they grew commercially. So I took as many seed as I could from as many different bushes, grew seedlings, and these seedlings were up to about 40 centimeters tall. And when a minus 12 frost hit, all the bought trees on rootstock were killed completely, the rootstock including, and the seedlings didn't even change color. So those seedlings are now the basis of my orchard. I've taken seed from those seedlings, and this year I've taken my first fruit from my third generation seeds, with the idea of doing another generation.
We'll have to talk a little
I'm
bit more
looking.
about that when we get to different crops you're working on. So, how much
Yes.
space are you dealing with, and what soil type?
My garden itself, not including the orchard or where I grow potatoes, is 800 square meters, and the potato patch is about 300 square meters. I keep the potatoes and the orchard separate, mainly because I just find that potatoes can be quite a weed if you don't get all of the potatoes. So I like to sort of grow them in the one bed. I rotate the bed. I leave it fallow for 3 years before going back to the same spot again. So I just rotate it. The orchard is around about 2,000 square meters, and the rest of our property is 5.2 hectares, 15 acres. So we vary from one end of the property to the other. At the very northern end, you're straight into river stones, and we're talking big stones. Where my garden is at the point where you're leaving the stones and you're starting to get into a soil, a reasonable soil level, 15 centimeter type of level of soil, but there's no clay underneath. It's straight into shingle after that. The further I head down towards the southern end of the property, I start getting into the heavier soil and clay underlay as well. If I'd known in those early days where the best soils was, I really should have had my garden further down the property. I'm just finding nowadays I'm finding it easier now to bring clay in, and I'm actually mixing clay into my garden to try and convert it more to a loam type soil. Because of the lack of clay underneath, it does tend to dry out a fair bit. Because as I said, the climate can be a bit of a challenge. Because last summer we can get days of humidity down to 12-14%, and when you're at 28-30 degrees and you've got 12-13% humidity, it's very, very hard on soil moisture levels. So there's a fair bit of watering required. It's a trick. The water's a tricky one. We have a water table that's fed from our local stream, and it's fed through the alluvial shingle that comes from the foothills of the Southern Alps. And when the weather is in a wet period, our water table can be as high as 30 centimeters below ground. So it's very close to the surface. When we get into a drought like we are at the moment, that water table goes down to 4 meters, 4 meters
Jeez.
down. So it's quite a drop. It's mainly being taken by a lot of dairy farmers, and even a deer farmer up the road who they pump and irrigate in their paddocks. So it's luckily I have a water gallery that's down deep enough that I don't actually go dry. That water actually flows on top of a 2 meter layer of clay at 5 meters down. Below that layer of clay is actually about 300 meters of more alluvial shingle, but the water below that is extremely pure because that comes from the Southern Alps. But it's quite expensive to get out. The top layer of that water that I use has a fair amount of nitrates from farming, but I just view that as free fertilizer,
A lot of people
and
don't
hence why.
realize that New Zealand has, I think, the second highest rate of synthetic fertilizer application in the world.
Yes, that's
It's
right.
very intensive agriculture.
Yeah. And even in my area, like if you were to convert the number of human beings to the number of cows, it works out just within my area is a population of 30,000 people doing poos and wees on the land. And so you'd see why there's a reasonable amount of nitrate in the soils. We're kind of lucky that the fact that when it finally does rain in the foothills, it only takes 2 weeks to, for that water table to fill up again. So the recharge is quite good.
So does that mean you don't need to add any other fertility to your systems? You just kind of rely on what's passing through?
I do. I actually use seawater. We cook with seawater, and then once we're finished cooking the seawater, we just spread that around, not only the garden but the potato patch and also the orchard as well.
That actually reminds me of a really fascinating bit of trivia I heard the other day. So, you know, in ancient times, an invading army would salt the fields of their
Yes.
enemy. And the reason why
Yes.
they did that, it wasn't to add so much salt that nothing would grow. What they actually used to do, salt was often a fertilizer because they knew that many crops grew better with just a little bit of salt. But if you added the wrong amount, the weeds would grow out of control and it would be really difficult to manage that agricultural land. So they were only
I
adding
did.
like a catalytic amount of salt to make it difficult for the enemy to like rebuild their civilization because the weeds
It's
would just go
interesting.
crazy.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
It makes sense
I
when you think
know
about it. They wouldn't be moving like tons and tons and tons of salt around just to
No.
destroy a couple of acres.
No, that's right. I use roughly, what am I doing with? About 160 liters per year on the garden. So that's spread out quite thinly. But also the sodium chloride is actually, it's quite mobile. And when you've got soils like we have in New Zealand, the sodium nitrate, the sodium's washed out very quickly.
Yeah, it doesn't hang
And
around for long. I think I
it
have the
doesn't.
same thing with the salt lick that my goats feed on. That goes into the manure that then helps some vegetables grow that would otherwise have a hard time on my mineral mix.
Yes, that's right. And so that's one of my main imports. The key is really to try and close up your nutrient loss as much as you can. And that's where composting toilets come in. And I think if you can, I haven't got a composting toilet. I'd like to eventually get to that stage because I think that then you really are plugging that gap of nutrient loss. And then every time you bring in even a meal of fish or whatever, you're increasing your nutrient level within your soil, aren't you?
What about weeds and pests? What are they like in your area and how do you deal with them?
Pests. We're actually quite lucky, really. We don't have a lot of problems. In the garden, my main pest would have to be the blackbird. When it's searching for worms, it does most of the cultivating for me. It just flicks the soil everywhere. We don't have problems with any animals. We do have wild deer and wild pigs, but they don't tend to come near humanity. They tend to stay well clear of. And that's something I always find fascinating when you see deer in North America or in other parts of the world, and they see them walking through their garden. Why don't the same animals come walking through our gardens? Or the magpie in Australia, you'll see the magpie walk into people's houses and steal cat food. But the same bird will never ever go near you in this country. It's just they behave differently. It's quite odd, isn't it? Yeah.
I don't have any answers to that, except that that kind of culture in a wild species can change when conditions change and can surprise people. Like an organism that you barely even noticed was there can suddenly become a huge problem if they teach each other to behave a different way.
Yeah, that's right. The likes of the magpie and the spur-winged plover and the kookaburra and what else can I think of? The various other parrots, they've all self-introduced themselves to this country. And people think, well, why did they bring those over to New Zealand? But they arrived here on their own. It's quite fascinating. A lot of those bird species were blown to this country for millions of years, but because there wasn't an environment here for them to survive in, they never got themselves established. But as soon as we cleared the bush away and put in pastures, these species were able then to get themselves established. Yeah.
And weeds, did you mention any weeds that you have to deal with and
Weeds.
your strategies?
Well, we have the usual weeds that I think that plague everyone else around the world. you know, your fat hen and your chickweed and all those ones. I see one of the questions was to do with was the rhizome grasses.
Oh, yes. Yeah, from the audience. Because you mostly use mulch for your weed control?
No. But because of previous experience we call it twitch. Couch grass is another word for it. There's probably different names for it all around the world, isn't it? I suppose there's different species of the spreading grasses too. There's quite a number of them. I'd had a previous experience with it, and when we bought this property 23 years ago, I decided that I didn't want to have to battle dealing with this particular grass. So what I did was I set about square by square, I'm talking 40 centimetres by 40 centimetres, with the use of two wheelbarrows, I took off the top layer, put it into one wheelbarrow, which contained the twitch, and it was a mat, just a complete mat of it when we came here. Put that top layer into a wheelbarrow, dug out the subsoil, put that into another wheelbarrow, and then I put the twitch and the grass into the bottom of that hole and put the subsoil on top. And I ended up doing the 800 square metres, completely digging the whole thing over, double digging it, burying the twitch. And I think after the end of that, I only had about two pieces that actually came up after all that work. So I don't have any of that grass in the garden. On the eastern side, the northern side, and on the southern side, I have trees around that stop it from spreading back in. On the northern side is where I grow my feijoas, and I did actually find a little colony of twitch a couple of years ago. And what I do with it is that because I live in the middle of dairy farming country, there's huge amounts of silage plastic. It's a plastic they use for covering silage, and they're happy just to give it away. And so I just use that stuff and I lay it on top of the twitch. I put rocks on top of it and I leave it for 2 years. And by the time you take your plastic away, the twitch is all dead. And then if I find another infestation somewhere else on the property, I'll just move it onto the new spot and just keep it contained that way there. I don't really like to use Roundup. I do like to try and grow a garden holistically. We don't claim to be organic because we're not registered. You can't use that word, I suppose, unless you're registered, even though I think it's a very generic term, isn't it, really? Yeah.
It's a very stretched term today. It's hard to know what it actually means. Yeah.
Yes. So yeah, we don't use anything really artificial. We don't sort of need to really. And it's really interesting actually when you start to build up your soil health, just how things on their own seems to cure themselves. Like for example, in my garlic, I have white rot, quite a common fungal disease. Bacterial, I think, a bacterial problem in garlic. I've had it in my garden for ever since we moved here. I bought it in unknowingly. In those early years, I'd lose 50% of my garlic to white rot. As the years have gone by, it's getting to the stage now. Out of 500 plants, I may only lose two, maybe three. So it really does come down to just good soil health. In a lot of ways, and when you've got that soil health, you don't really have a lot of problems. We've got the typical old white butterfly. I think only Antarctica hasn't got bloody white butterfly. I think today,
give it time; it'll turn up there too.
Yes, yeah, that, and of course, being in dairy farming country, all the dairy farming neighbours are forever growing brassica crops. So you can imagine just the sheer number of white butterflies we have during February and March are the main times. I've just found myself, I'm just better off to use insect nets. Otherwise, you really don't get good plants by the time you want them sort of going into winter. The white butterflies just destroy them. Some places in New Zealand, you don't see a lot of them, but here you do. Other pests, I'm just trying to think what other pests we've got. Now there's not a lot really. We don't get a lot of white fly. Aphids can be a minor thing. You don't get a lot of those either.
Just a seasonal thing that comes and goes.
Yeah, that comes and goes. It's funny, whitefly can be one of those ones you can get. You can get 1 year, and then the next year you won't see it. Or even a couple of years, you might go without it. So they sort of come and go, really. Yeah, so we're quite lucky in that respect. It's a challenging climate weather-wise, because at the moment we're going through a fairly severe drought at the moment, which we tend to get these sort of droughts once every 5 years. We'll get a drought like we have. We've only had 61 mils since the start of the year, which is just over 2 inches. They normally break by now because winter is our wet time of the year, and there is certainly no sign of any rain in the next 2 weeks. So we're going to go into winter with soil that's still bone dry, which is a bit of a worry, because the temperatures get low enough that even if you do get rain, you don't get a lot of growth because the temperatures are not quite high enough to get a lot. In some winters, we even get to the stage where the frost get heavy enough that the grass turns yellow. The last few years, we're not seeing as much of that those level of temperatures, and we're still getting a wee bit of growth in the garden. Mm. And then we can get wet periods where it just doesn't seem to stop raining, so it goes from one extreme to the other.
Yeah, as an Australian, I can relate to that. Occasionally, you get an evenly keeled year, but it's usually back and forth between extremes.
Yeah, one very good feature about this place here is we never ever get big hail. Mm. We'll get hail at the size of your little fingernail, nothing more than the sort of the size of a pea. Mm. That's quite reassuring, because you just know that you're not going to get destroyed by a big storm that comes over and destroys your garden. The thunderstorms that we do get here are typical sort of inland storms that develop over one spot, and they're normally middle of summer, and they're normally a very warm rain. So they're great when you do get those type of storms.
Mm. So moving on to the meat of the chat, what are your priorities in crop breeding? Like, what are your kind of broad things that you're working towards?
How many years we got?
This is just to get a general overview about, like, what do you really value when you're selecting and breeding crops for your area?
I'm really enjoying the decloning is one. Doing the potatoes, mm-hmm. the garlic, and what I'm referring to as, back to a South American name, is camote, or sweet potato, or locally called kumara. Mm. So I've had success in the camote, thanks to Mark in the US, who shared some of his seed. And
wonderful work.
And
it goes to show the power of just one person starting that process and then being willing to share it far and wide. Like, his work is going to have a lasting impact across the entire world.
Yes, that's right. But I found that his seed wasn't producing seed for me. It would have flowers, but in those first two or three years, it just would not produce seed. Mm. I gave some cuttings to a kumara grower in the North Island, and he hand-pollinated over his kumara and using the camote, and he gave me some seed back again, and bingo, that cross then produced seed for me. Mm. The last season, unfortunately, many growers in this area got caught out by a very sneaky frost, and it really hammered my poor old plants right back to ground level, and they managed to come away again, but they never really did well enough to produce seed. Mm. Those plants now, I took cuttings for those, and they're now sitting happily in the front window of our house, and they can go back outside again, and I'll have another try next season to get another generation of seed.
It's another huge advantage of having seed producing strains of those usually clonally produced crops, in that you can have a backup storage. Like, you can put dry seed away for 5 or 10 years if you do it really well. And if you have those extreme weather events that take out all your vegetative material, you've got something to fall back on.
But that's right. And that has been one of the features that I certainly push when I'm talking to gardeners, is that both with the potato and the camote, the kumara, is to work towards that seed. Have that safeguard. Always have that safeguard on hand. Mm. You know, and of course, you use the Irish famine as an example of, if that famine wouldn't have happened, if those people had known that they could save those berries, if only they had known, that wouldn't have happened. The garlic has been a real battle. Actually, it's been a real battle to try and get true seed from the garlic. We have a rust in this country that has spread from the top to the bottom, and that has really shortened the lifespan of the garlic through the season, and it's made it a lot harder for us to get seed. We had, before the rust became an issue, we had a community garden in the top of the North Island who one lady had accidentally grown seed on her garlic, and she had the fortune to, or the wisdom to actually plant that seed, and she managed to get a generation of garlic grown from that true seed. So we, myself and another grower, we have that as a source of our garlic as well. But we also got seed in from Avron, who manages Garlicana. I think he's in Oregon in the States. So we've also got some seed from him as well. So we are playing with it. I came
Is that region broadly similar in climate to yours? Like, you're similar to that Pacific Northwest?
Not so much climate, but certainly latitude. I think actually I always look at Eugene as being, and that's in Oregon. I think it's in Oregon. Yeah, I think that's the same latitude as us. And if you go across, it's sort of New York, and so you can compare that sort of as latitude. But Oregon, the central Oregon's a lot colder in winter, but you know, a lot hotter in summer.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you've got a much more evened out maritime climate because everything's relatively close to the ocean.
Yeah, relatively. Not so much where I am. I've got the Southern Alps to our west, and we've got three lowish mountain ranges between us and the sea. Mm. So we don't get a lot of sea breezes during the summer. So we have a pretty good summer actually inland here, but the cold air does tend to get trapped in winter. So we do experience some reasonable frost. So the garlic, I managed to get one single seed this year, and it was the first pod that I'd managed to, that I'd broken open. Oh, yay, one seed. And I dropped it. Oh, I couldn't believe it. Yeah. But myself and two other people within our core group of garlic growers, we've been sharing seed or bulbs around the country. And we also sell the bulbs on the Sentinel Group website as well. So there is a lot of true seed garlic going out around the country. And the people that receive the bulbs are made aware of its potential, and we're encouraging more of them to have a go to try and get seed themselves. But thank goodness we've actually had one person this year who's actually to the south of us, he's further towards the bottom of the South Island, who has managed to grow 24 seeds. So that's the first person to achieve it.
Can I ask some questions just to like whisper in your collective ear over there? Other allium species, do they suffer from this rust as well, or is it just on garlic?
Leeks seem to be the second most susceptible to it, mm-hmm. but they're not a problem for leeks. Not an issue at all. Onions don't seem to get it.
Interesting. You know that allium is this really big, hyperdiverse genus. They're pretty much all edible, if you don't mind eating a kind of spicy leaf. And I just see a huge amount of untapped potential for wide hybridization between allium species. And there's a lot of ornamental alliums, I think, are grown in New Zealand, if you look at the horticulture industry. So if there's some intrepid New Zealander out there who is growing and flowering garlic, who wouldn't mind gathering as many other alliums as they can and just mix them all up anytime you get pollen of another species, see if you can create a whole new kind of garlic.
Yeah. Well, they're actually also they're prone to mutation as well.
Yes. They probably have to be. They haven't had sex in like 1,000 years.
The classic one's got to be the walking onion, the Egyptian walking onion. Mm-hmm. What you read online on Wikipedia is not correct. It is not a cross between a Welsh white onion and an unknown onion. It's a simple mutation. And it's because I got to F2s. I managed to get seed twice from the walking onion, and the progeny from that seed line is exactly the same as the original walking onion. There's nothing different about the two generations since. To me, if it was a hybrid, you'd have to get some variation.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is none. So I believe it's a mutation, and it's a mutation like. In fact, I actually found a photograph, and I should have sent it to you, of a mutation that turned up in a patch of Pukekohe Long Keeper. Pukekohe Long Keeper red onion. Mm-hmm. And it grew the most bizarre bulbils on the end of these big long tassels. And it was just one plant out of the blue. And it was on Homegrown Goodness. There's a thread on there that you can go and look it up, actually. And that never reverted back to flowers again. I did so many generations. I did about six or seven generations growing those bulbils every year. But it had nothing going for it. So it never kept very well. It grew an onion, but it was a real poor keeper.
Mm.
And in the end, I thought to myself, why am I doing this? just because it's so different and unique. So I let it go in the end and couldn't see the point. Yeah. So I'm working on sweet corn because the corn is a cultivar or a species that we can't bring into New Zealand. And so I decided that I'd just work with what we already have here in New Zealand. I decided that I was going to work with a one colour only, just the golden colour. I gathered up two heirlooms. There's one called Golden Bantam. I think that's an international one too. And the other one's the one that left my mind there. It's an heirloom that Kawanga Gardens actually hold. Early Gem, it's called. And then I used all the F1 hybrids that I could find in garden centres and catalogues and whatever. And I mixed them all together. And it was fascinating what came from that. In that first generation, I would have had 10% had purple cobs.
Oh, wow.
So where did the purple come? So it shows you just how far back the genetics can throw. So I saved the purple. I thought, I'm really fascinated with the purple, actually. So I saved the best plants, the strongest, tallest plants with the biggest cobs, the biggest seeds, and used the purples. And from that, the following year, I ended up getting white cobs. Really fascinating. And so I grew the white, but I was getting both dent and flint on the same cobs.
Mm.
So even to throw back to flint as well, I found fascinating because there was no flint in the original mix. So
if I recall correctly, Steve Solomon, I don't know if you know his work, he's in Tasmania now, originally from northern US. He did a similar thing, but he took commercial F1, you know, supposedly inbred and useless industrial strains of corn and just mixed them all up and then started selecting for what he wanted.
Yes.
And
yeah,
he's of the opinion that you shouldn't be a purist when it comes to breeding. Just with rare exceptions, any diversity is worth throwing into the mix, provided you're prepared to do the selection that has to come afterwards.
Yes. That's right. But and when you do that, you certainly notice some very, very bizarre and unusual plants. You know, last year I had a plant that grew some cobs no more than 3 or 4 centimetres from the ground.
Wow.
A total screw up. You certainly wouldn't want to be taking any seed from it. So I grew those whites.
It could be pollinated by kiwi birds.
Yeah, not many kiwis around here, unfortunately. So I grew the white. And it threw heavily to the dent instead of the flint this year. Very, very little of the flint, which is quite good. So I want to select for a sweet corn, and I found the flavors has been very good, but they've dried to be a slightly sort of somewhere between the typical golden color and a white. They're not pure white, but I have noticed that there's a few seeds that are much whiter than others. So I'll gather up the more whiter of those and have another go at those next year. Now, but I find them really fascinating. I really enjoy the sweet corn. So I haven't been overly bold with my mixes up till the last couple of years. I've done smaller Grex mixes. Beetroot, for example, I did cylindrical, I did bull's blood and Detroit, I forgot what they call it, Detroit's. Oh, it doesn't matter. The three of those, and I did a mix of those about 5 or 6 years ago, and I've just been really just selecting on nice dark colours. The ones, the darker the purple, the better. I've been selecting for those, but also selecting. But it's fascinating, actually. The cylindricals actually disappeared. Even the first year cross, I had very, very little longer type of bases. But I do find that they don't do as well in our climate as well, because you can pretty much leave those in the garden all winter, but they don't handle frost quite as well as the round beetroot for some reason. I don't know what it is. So I'm not too worried that trait has pretty much disappeared from the beetroot.
Do you have any extra challenges with the biennial crops for breeding, or does that open more opportunities for selecting them during that dormant phase?
The biennial. The
The
biennial feature,
carrots and the beets.
I like to base my growing of those biennials by growing them for as long as I can, having the longest possible season for them, sowing them as early as you can to encourage those early bolters. And this year has been a good example in summer radishes. I can't remember the number that I mixed up this year, something like about 12 different radishes that I've managed to buy. And I've mixed them all up, but I sowed them early summertime because that's about when you're going to get a lot of bolting, and they've been bolting now for the last month, and they'll bolt well into the winter. I'll probably lose 90%, but then I've planted, I must have 300 to 400 plants at least, so I'm expecting 90% of those to be gone by winter, which I'm quite, people say, oh, that's a bit of a shame, isn't it? I says, no, that's great, that's what I want. You're after that bolting,
Well,
and it's the
this is
same.
what I love to see. You've set up the conditions to allow the plants to show you what they're capable of doing. I think that's a really
Yes.
important factor, a consideration. And it's the same
Yes.
with like pest or disease or drought resistance. You have to subject the plants to that stress in order to be able to select for the traits that you're looking for.
Yes, that's right, and you. Sometimes you do find though that you can breed out a trait like bolting, but as soon as you bring some more seed back into the mix, you bring the bolting back again. So it can have a downside to it as well. But then if you're just constantly selecting for that bolting, well and good. Black Spanish radish, I haven't done any cross breeding with it, but it's a variety that I've been growing for the last 20 years, and I've heavily selected that for bolting, and because it's now a low bolter, you can grow some ginormous radishes because it's you can grow it for a longer time of your season. And that's where our website, the Sentinels Group Seeds, comes in, is the fact that we're aiming for that home market, that the home grower, and the home grower wants a crop that's going to produce the most and
Over a long
produce
season. You
over a
don't
longer period.
want all to turn up on the same day unless it's a variety for preserving where you need like
Yes.
batches to be a certain size to be worth doing.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you suspect a lot of heirloom vegetable genetics hasn't been selected consistently? Like interesting genes are still in there, but a lot of the performance and the quality it has been lost long ago.
It has to, doesn't it? I would say the work that's carried out by Kay Baxter at Kawanga and her crew, they certainly work very, very hard on trying to maintain as much diversity as they can within their seed lines. But they focus heavily on heirlooms, and but I suppose that you can only maintain so much genetics, can't you? There's only so much.
You've got to have that attention to like every plant needs to be looked at and assessed and a decision made. And if you're trying
Yes.
to maintain 100, 200 different lines of heirlooms, it's just impossible to
Yeah.
like I think one person can probably manage about 10 different crops and give them the attention and the love that they need.
Yes. Mind you, that's where freezing comes in. We freeze a lot of our seed. That way there we can work on a lot more crops. Like, for example, I have myself, I do 90 different lines within our website, and there's no way I could achieve that if it wasn't for the freezing of the seed. And like you can do one variety 1 year and freeze it, and then do another one the next year, and you could do quite a few that way.
That might be a good chance to segue. So one thing I really wanted to talk to you about is to get an idea of how you've built the Sentinels as a community distributed seed saving and plant breeding organization in what's a relatively
Right.
small and dispersed population in New Zealand. I would love to do a similar thing here in my community. So I'm
Yes.
looking to you for ideas about strategies for doing that.
It was actually my accountant that said to me one day, he says, well, why don't you start up your own one? And I went away and thought about it. I think, why not? I thought it would be quite a good idea. And I wanted to base it on a vendor type co-op sort of a system. And so it started off with a core group of four of us. There was one other grower who was also a member of the Homegrown Goodness Forum, who I'd met through the forum, and I talked him into joining up. And there was another gardener an hour's drive away from me that someone else had mentioned that this person was, he loved growing seed. And so I went and met him, and I said, do you want to come and join us? And yep. And there's and even Sue Sinclair, who's another, some good friends of mine who live not too far from me, they were quite keen on the idea too. So the four of us, we had a website built and set up for ourselves, and we decided we're going to keep it rather sort of earthly. We weren't going to worry about fancy packaging, and we were just going to just keep it very, very simple. It had to be holistic. We had to, you know, keep it organic, as they say, non-certified. And we decided we're just going to just grow it organically, not worry about advertising, just put it out there and just let it grow. And every year.
Can you clarify how it works? There's individual growers produce seed, and then that all gets packaged up and put into the central kind of hub for selling it to customers.
Yes. So all the seed comes to me.
Yeah.
And so it all goes into the one freezer. So it's the co-op freezer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do the packaging and the mail out. The grower gets paid a portion of the packet price,
mm-hmm.
and myself as an administrator gets a portion as well, and another portion then is retained for the day-to-day management of the bank account and purchases.
Now, as someone who does a little bit of selling my own seed on the sides, I can see the appeal of that, because there's like this critical mass that you need to reach in order to appeal to a wide enough range of customers to like bring in a consistent flow of people looking for material.
Yeah.
And if you just do it on your own, you're like a little tiny ember that's about to be snuffed out. You need to pile up enough of those to get a flame going.
Yeah, no, that's right. And hence why we're up to 9 growers now.
Mm.
And
do you worry about it getting too big? Is there like an upper limit? Like, is it starting to reach as big as you want to handle?
Because we're over 350 in the range now. And it's kind of reaching the point where you don't really want to get too big.
Mm.
And I always have this idea of maybe 12 growers. And then we'd just keep it at 12.
Mm.
And that would be enough. But it's interesting, actually, as the years have gone by, because we've been going since 2015. But we're starting to get a bit of a cult following, you know. You're seeing the same names every year,
mm.
and it's interesting. You see, you'll recognize the street that the seeds are going to,
mm-hmm.
and it's a neighbor and another person down the road, and mm-hmm. so you know then that people are talking and they're recommending your seed. But it's the fact that you're selecting for the home gardener, and I'm positive that's got to make a difference, because so much of the seed in New Zealand from the major retailers is actually grown in Italy and places like that.
Yeah, in greenhouses.
And you just can't expect it to do as well.
Mm.
And so, and also I'm noticing too that there are people who, they like to have a bit of an email chat with you. And then there's a few of them who are actually mentioning Joseph Lofthouse too, that they've read Joseph's book, and they've actually gone out and seeking it. Is there anyone actually doing this sort of work in New Zealand?
Yep, and there you are.
And they've really been happy that they've actually found someone who's doing likewise. Within our group of growers, I'm the only one that's really doing this type of work. Nev's doing a wee bit, not to the same extent. He still likes to pot around with different things. He's really good on his potato, and he's really got a wonderful collection of potatoes. But the rest of the growers are quite traditional. You know, if they want to stick with the heirlooms, they're most entitled to. I can't dictate to them what they can't and cannot grow. It's especially when you're a vendors type system, isn't it?
And I still see heirlooms as being a useful resource for some people. They just like to grow an heirloom, but for breeders, being able to tap into like 10 or 20 or 30 old diverse varieties, even if they're degraded, they're still really useful.
Yes, that's right, and that's why I sort of promote the saving of those cultivars, because we need to hang on to all that genetics as well. I'm also involved in the Southern Seed Exchange based in Christchurch, where we maintain what's left of the collection Unfortunately, the Southern Seed Exchange went through a bit of a lull the last 15 years, and also a burglary. Someone got into the storage shed and stole all the flowers. They were looking for poppy seeds, so they stole all the flower collection. So we're now trying to build the collection back up again. But we've introduced freezing into that system as well,
To
so
keep the
then we don't
quality
have to.
longer.
Yeah, we
It
don't have to worry about.
makes me think, though, on this topic of organizations getting too big and having like logistical problems when they get beyond too big a size. But like splitting a large organization into two smaller ones also means that if one of those goes through a disaster or politics or, just loses momentum, the other one
Yes.
is more likely to continue. So I don't know, a culture of reaching critical mass, but then not allowing things to grow too big before they get split into relatively independent but still interconnected sub-organizations. I wonder if that's
Yeah.
something to consider in the future.
Yeah, with Sentinels, for example, because as you say, all the seed is in one freezer. You know, what happens if I got flooded out or something like that? But then most of the growers will still retain some of their own seed anyway. You'd get most of that seed back again. It would be my own. It would be my own seed that would be at jeopardy. So no, you're right. Yeah, that's a good point you make, actually, is to be able to, and potentially it would probably wouldn't be a silly idea to actually have some of that seed at someone else's place, to spread that seed out, and just in case of the what if,
Yeah, just to
you
have a
know, that.
backup.
That Aurora that just recently was an example. You know, we could have. I heard the other day that the corona burst out of the sun was off to one side of that sun. If it had been more direct towards Earth, we would have had major problems with our electricity system. I thought, well, you know, you could have lost your freezer then. So very precarious at the best of the times, isn't it? And
And this, I heard the Svalbard seed store up in Norway, the ice around it has started melting, so it's not going to be as cold as they hoped it would be.
Yeah, well, time will tell within that, you know, which way it actually goes in the next few years. If
If
you
it gets colder, they may not be able to get into it. It might become so isolated. So either extreme. But I mean, the safest place for plants is growing. The storage is great, but they need to grow as well.
that's actually a very, it's a good point you make about, you know, could it actually get to the stage where that vault covers over with ice again? You wouldn't know, would you?
Can we go into the actually, let's do some of the audience questions first. This is a new feature. So if you're listening and you would like to submit questions to future guests, I've started putting a post up on the Discourse forum for Going to Seed. So anyone can join that up. It's an amazing, lively community of plant breeders around the world. So we've gathered a few questions from the audience to ask to Richard. So one we've got is, so do you only garden with hand tools or like, and if
Yeah.
so, what's your motivation for doing that?
Just having the skill and the knowledge how to grow food, if you didn't have any fossil fuel to run your machines, and it's actually quite simple, really. The question that was put to us was using lawnmowers and chainsaws as well. But yeah, I do have a lawnmower for the lawns around the house, and I do have a chainsaw for firewood. But the garden itself, I only use a wheelbarrow, shovel, a hoe, and a steak knife. I like a steak knife when I'm going around plants and just, you know, cutting off weeds. I also have a flame thrower as well, a big flame weeder, and I find those brilliant, especially when you plant garlic and in the first generation of weed comes up and you just blow them off. I love them. It's a great machine.
One of my
So
main motives for not using machines when I'm farming is because I love listening to podcasts while I'm doing
yeah. Yeah, no.
it.
No, I just find you don't necessarily have to have any power tools in the garden, because I do. I have the garden split up into two size beds. There's one bed that's 1 meter wide, and they can be up to 20 meters long. And every 4, maybe 5 years, I like to add the compost that I make. I like to add some compost to those beds. I can't put it on top, leave it on top, because the blackbirds will just send it flying. So I have no choice but to dig it in. And so I dig it under. But that's only done once every 4 years or so. And the other beds where I grow alternate between pumpkins, squash, and corn every other year. And I haven't dug those areas for 15, 16 years since I double dug the whole area. I just use organic straw from a local organic farm and just layer that on top. And for the winter, I just sow dinkle wheat into that straw, throw it over the top before I put the straw down, and it just grows through the straw and covers it over for the winter. Come springtime, if I need to plant the pumpkins, I just pull all that stuff, leave it on top, and put the pumpkins in amongst it. And the birds are not able to flick that stuff around. So but yet very hard to try and grow carrots and parsnips and all those things in amongst that straw. You just can't do it. You've just got to have bare soil beds. So no, the answer is no, I don't need power tools in my garden, really.
Another audience question, and this is a broad one. Do you feel like your breeding work has been successful so far? And would you have changed anything in the past looking back?
Looking back, I wished I'd introduced genetics earlier into my carrot because it was so inbred, but it still grew okay, but I was inbreeding. I suppose, the big success has been that Feijoa. The fact that I've now got a plant that can handle extreme frost. I'd like to know actually how cold those Feijoas can get to, and if there's a grower in North America who would like some seed from my Feijoas who experiences colder temperatures than what we get, I'd be happy to share some seed
Put them through
just
their
out of
paces.
right.
It's funny, like I've planted a lot of fruit trees from seed, and when you do it that way, like a lot of people are put off planting fruit trees from seed because they think it's going to take so long before you get a crop, and it does, but they're not, if you do it right, they're not years of fiddling with the plants, they're years of just putting them out and letting them figure it out for themselves, because
Yes.
you
Yeah.
want things to fail if they need fiddling with. That's the whole point. And
Yeah.
for me, a good fruit plant, a good woody fruit tree, is something that you plant and you harvest and you do nothing else. Like that's enough
Yes.
work.
Yeah, that's right. And my orchard is 100% seed grown apple trees and peaches and so forth. And you don't need to have them on rootstock. They grow perfectly fine, just on their own roots.
Now we'll get to the bonus round questions because we're getting close to the hour.
The bonus.
If you could like wave a magic wand and work wonders with any species, what would you create?
Oh, good question. What would I create? A frost tolerant pineapple or a banana.
With the pineapples, that's not actually such a far-fetched idea because there are a lot of frost-tolerant bromeliads from South America, and some of them have edible fruits, and pretty much all of the bromeliads hybridize with each other. So get to it, people. Someone can do it.
I think our problem in this country, you wouldn't be able to get the seed in.
No, someone in the US would probably have much better access to the starting material. But yeah, I
I
think it's
do.
very doable.
I there is a red pineapple that grows a smaller pineapple, and I know that grows out on the coast from me. There are people that can grow down the coast, but I'm sort of more. I want to focus more on crops that actually produce a good level of food production, and instead of having to put a lot of effort into these tropical plants like pineapple, where you get one fruit and takes you a whole year to get one fruit, and the effort you've got to put into it, I would rather put that into crops that I can guarantee better success out of, and I can focus on the ones that are more marginal. Like I'm focusing on figs because figs will grow here, but I've just got to have them set in the right spot. Some of the guavas, the pineapple guava, which actually that's what the Feijoa is called, isn't it? The pineapple guava, isn't it? They called that overseas, I think.
Guava common names are all over the place in different regions because there's so many overlapping species. So I wouldn't hazard a guess there. Next question. What is your vision for the future of food in your community?
What is the vision for the food? Well, in the garden wise, well, I suppose the key is that the key is security, food security, isn't it? And in this part of the world, you just cannot go past the potato. The potato produces calorie wise calories per square meter. You can't go past the potato. It's in some parts in the States, it's the sweet potato. We always hear Mark who's talking about the sweet potatoes than where he is in the States. He'll get far more sweet potato than what he ever potatoes. So I suppose every area has its crop that does better for some people. Parsnips, I find that are also extremely productive per square meter as well. In my area, I'm in a farming area, so it's very much animal based, not so much horticultural. So, yeah, in this area, it would be based around protein, protein on the hoof. So, yeah.
So, how do you hope to pass your work onto future generations? And I think you're probably one of the most advanced guests in this regard because you're doing so much work on outreach and sharing the material that you're producing.
I think the best thing that I can do is just simply keep having open days like I do quite regularly. I have a group that come here every month, and so they can see progress from month to month. Mm. And I think it's better than having just one for the month or one for the year, and then that's it. So they come every 4 weeks, besides the winter time when there's nothing really much to see in the garden. But also promoting it through Facebook pages and stuff like that. Just promoting the growing of food. A lot more schools nowadays are working on school gardens as well. So it's good to see that there's more of a push now to teaching kids where food comes from. It doesn't come from Woolworths or the
supermarket. Do schools ever order seeds from the Sentinels?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah. A couple of schools do. But they're also into teaching kids about even just growing native trees as well. It's all about if they just grow something. So yeah, it's all about encouraging the next generation, isn't it?
It makes you really wonder, if you are a young person who started breeding a particular crop and kept it up, what you could do in a whole lifetime versus, I mean, these days we normally get into it when we're later in life.
Yes.
And you've only got so many seasons ahead of you to actually make progress. It's an interesting thing to think about that there's like the first decades of people's lives. It's a missed opportunity that maybe there's a way of tapping into that in the future.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, that's dead right. Yeah.
So what's your final message to people who are thinking of getting into crop breeding?
Crop breeding. Obviously, if you don't know a lot about it, these books there, or Carol Depp and Joseph Lofthouse, there's a number of different growers out there who are focusing on the Grex crossing and working towards land race breeding. Joseph was certainly my inspiration for sort of changing my mindset from heirlooms only to all the different cultivars together. So it's Joseph's fault. Thank goodness. No, he's been an inspiration to a lot of people, actually.
I'm having flashbacks to his very early website that I stumbled onto, and I think I can trace a lot of my development to the work that he's done as well.
Yeah, and it was the homegrown goodness forum that I learned a lot on that forum. I don't know whether that forum's still going or not these days.
Oh well, there's always new places popping up, like the Going to Seed discourse group. So there's always things coming and going. So
and
final
Facebook.
And Facebook's great too. So final end plug opportunity. How can people get in touch with you or learn more about what you are doing?
Yeah, well, Sentinels Group Seeds. Let's look it up online. We actually do send some seed overseas. Certain countries we certainly don't send to Australia because seeds are not allowed to be imported to Australia. Europe seems to be reasonably open to seed imports. I'm not sure about the states quite so much. I think some states within the United States are a bit stricter than others. But most of our seeds just go within New Zealand.
I'll post all of the links to your website and the work that you're doing.
Thank you very
so
much.
That if people want to read up more, they can have a look.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to chat today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been an honour, actually.
If you want your vegetables to have a genuine zest for life, then Joseph Lofthouse's book, Landrace Gardening, is for you. Here's what readers are saying. A short, inspiring, informative read that blew my mind at least once per chapter. Everything is far more productive and delicious than ever before. The best book I've read on gardening in ages. Get your copy of Landrace Gardening now, and start growing locally adapted varieties.